This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. Coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Lewis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm thrilled to share with you a recent interview. I conducted it actually on Monday as part of our Black, Brown and Green Voices series. I had the pleasure of interviewing Debo Patrick Adigbele. Debo is a renowned civil rights lawyer, someone who has committed his career to the law and to ways in which he can make, in his way and his team's way, society a fairer place. The middle name Patrick might be the signal there. He's of Irish descent. His mother was a Dubliner, an immigrant from inner city Dublin to New York in the mid-1950s. His dad was from Nigeria, and his mom and dad met in New York, and the rest is history as far as Debo and his brother's lives are concerned. It's a pleasure to welcome Debo into our community of voices, building this archive of diverse ways in which people self-identify as being of Irish descent and of African descent. I didn't plan it this way. We were actually slated to do this event earlier in May, but we ended up doing it on Monday, the 23rd. And of course, this week, May 25th, is Africa Day, the big Africa Day celebration. So it was actually really nice timing that we were conducting this interview with Debo this week. And I really feel privileged and honored that through the medium of This Irish American Life and our wonderful friends at Irish Radio Network USA, that we're able to share this with our wider audience. Debo is just a good guy. He's an accomplished person, and it's really fascinating to hear a little bit, for the purposes of this audience in particular, his mother's trajectory and how she navigated New York when she arrived as an Irish immigrant in the mid-1950s. An unusual trajectory, and, you know, we're all the better for that degree of variety, of course, in the immigrant experience. So, without further ado, I'll be handing over. On the day, Debo was introduced by my colleague, Professor Kim DaCosta, but we'll go straight from me into my conversation with Debo from Monday last. Thanks, folks, and enjoy this other layer to our Black, Brown and Green Voices series. Debo, thank you. Maybe we'll start with your name, because one of the things that you mentioned when we were preparing for this chat today was your middle name. And I think your name says so much about who you are and maybe can kick off our conversation today in terms of how you ended up in New York and a little bit about your family background.
Great. Happy to start there. And thanks so much to Kim for connecting me to this wonderful project and the wonderful work you're doing, Miriam. I've enjoyed learning about the efforts and listening to some of and watching some of the videos. So my name, Adipawali Patrick Akande Adegbele, is quite a lot. It's like a vowel sandwich. There are so many vowels, seemingly few consonants. But one of the interesting things about my name is that when I was born and my parents chose my names. My mom chose my Nigerian, my Yoruba first name, Adebowale, which is A-D-E-B-O, which is where the Debo comes from, W-A-L-E. And in the Yoruba tradition, that name means crown comes home, because in that society, I was the first son of the first son. And so my name is Adebowale, crown comes home. And that's the name my mom chose. She chose my Nigerian name. And my dad chose my Irish middle name, which is Patrick. And so, you know, I go by Debo Patrick Adegbole. And when you have a name like that, almost in every conversation and every introduction takes you into the story, the origin story, and where that name comes from and how it came to be. And so I think you're quite right, Miriam, that is in a good segue into how there comes to be an Irish Nigerian in New York. And I know there are a couple, because my brother who works at NYU, Adermi Lekun Brian Adegbele, is also kicking around New York City.
So tell us then, that brings us nicely. It's really great that they swapped off in terms of picking the name from the opposite culture. Very egalitarian. That's wonderful. Tell us about your parents' journey. I believe they were both immigrants to New York, something that resonates very much with all that we do at Luxman Ireland House. So set the scene a little bit in terms of how you come to being in that sense.
Great. So in the 1950s, both of my parents were the eldest of six surviving children, I should say. And they both headed to New York from different continents, different parts of the world, Nigeria, a town called Ire outside of Ibadan in Nigeria. My dad came to study and to be educated here in the States. And my mom came from Dublin, from a modest upbringing living in a place called St. Joseph's Mansions, as I understand it, in Dublin. And she, as the eldest of six, set out on her journey to the United States when she was approximately 24 years old. And she traveled to New York City on a boat to be what was in effect a domestic worker for a wealthy family on Long Island, is how I understand she made the journey. And so she came and began working for that family in Long Island. And my dad came not too long after from Nigeria to the States to go to school. And they met in the 1960s in Midtown Manhattan at a restaurant that was called Schraff's, on a day when my mom was out with her friends from work and my dad was out with some of his friends from school. And as luck and fate would have it, they met each other in that restaurant. I should say that one of the early experiences that my mom relayed to me is that it's a big journey to take as a 24-year-old woman, and you know, setting off into a new world in a different place. And one of the unfortunate experiences she had very early on is that at night, when she was kneeling to say her prayers and to remember all of those who she left behind, the family for which she worked, for at least one member of the family would make fun of her at that time. And she remembered feeling the indignity, the sting of having her approach and her traditions challenged in that way. And I think that ultimately led her to separate from that initial employment and to head out to the big city, which is in part what led to her meeting my dad in the restaurant in that day. So dealing with the adversity of difference is in part a contributor to how those people from two different worlds with similar aspirations met each other in the 1960s in Manhattan.
So in that time, Debo, it would have been, you know, there were a significant number of Irish immigrants coming to places like New York, although the English cities were more common for where people went to from Ireland in that period. There's this mass migration off the island of Ireland in those very years that your mother is leaving. So does she, you know, it's unusual enough for people to kind of, you know, create partnerships with non-Irish people, not to mention a Nigerian immigrant. Do you have any sense of how they navigated their trajectories in that way, or if it was in any way difficult or anything?
Absolutely. So as I understand it, both of them were aware that in the 1960s in the United States that it was a bit of an unusual pairing. It was not a typical pairing. They understood that they came from vastly different places, different races, different religious denominations. But I think that each of them were committed to seeing through where their hearts and minds were, and their hearts and minds were open to people as people and wanting to understand each other and appreciate each other across differences and across place of birth and origin. And so in a sense, I think I view them as sort of courageous people, because there is a dimension of it that in the 1960s, even in New York, you had to be courageous a bit to step out and do that. But it's very important to know and to understand that in many parts of the United States, in the year I was born, 1966, my body, my existence would have been evidence of a crime under the criminal laws and the penal codes of many states in the United States. There was the famous case of Loving v. Virginia that went to the Supreme Court, and it was in that case that the laws banning interracial marriage and mixing were struck down as violating the United States Constitution. And so I'm very mindful of the fact that not only were there social pressures and things to navigate in New York City and in their immediate communities, but in the larger context of the nation in which they lived and in which their younger children would be born into, they also had to navigate that the pairing was actually evidence of criminal conduct. I think that's hard today for some people to understand as we walk around our cities, as we turn on our television, as we think about our recent leaders, as we look at the images that we see all around us. It's not that long ago that this was verboten in so many places. And I think understanding what it was like for them to come together is part of understanding that context. But they did have the strength of character and the courage to follow their aims and their hearts, and not to be chastened by the judgment of others. And so that's something that's an important lesson that I've taken with me.
And I think maybe we'll come back to may have informed your decision about what you would do in life, or maybe I'm overstating it, but we can maybe circle back to that a little bit. So tell me then, Devo, about your childhood for kids in families, their family unit is their norm. I'm always struck that my son always says to me, "Mom, you don't have an Irish accent." And I'm like, "What do you mean I don't have an Irish accent?" But to him, he doesn't hear my Irish accent. So our norms of our little worlds are our own little worlds in that sense. And can you tell us a little bit about your childhood in that way?
Yeah, so the thing that I remember about my house as a young person, my apartment in New York City, was that it was open to people from across the world. We had family visit from Ireland and Nigeria. We had friends who were from different European and African countries, where our apartment had sort of the decorations of the lands that my parents left behind. As an older person, I had the opportunity to travel to the Ellis Island Museum as that was reopened and sort of capturing the immigrant experience. And one thing that strikes you and helps you understand the commonality of people, regardless of where they come from, is how when you're going on a long journey and can't carry a lot with you, you bring some of the same types of things, right? The family photos, the little mementos, the books, the religious texts and books that matter to you. It's really interesting as you go to Ellis Island to see that people brought the same types of things. Some of it is the limit to what people could carry with them as they set off in the new world. But I think that's not the only piece of it. The other piece of it is that there is a common denominator of humanity and how we define ourselves. And so welcoming that rich difference into our lives in our apartment That was just the nature of things for us. And the great advantage for me and my brother and our family was that it led us to sort of treat difference as a thing to be welcomed and to explore and not something to be afraid of or resist. And I think that was a lesson that was not necessarily intentionally given to us, but it was the way that we walked in the world. And so we continue to sort of understand people and difference in that way, to approach things with curiosity and openness rather than with being closed off and with fear. And that was one of the great lessons of my early life. And it was really exciting to sort of hear about our family from abroad. As a young person, my mom's youngest sister, my Aunt Paula, came to live with us when I was a very young kid. And so she was kind of like a big sister to me. My mom had been like a second mother to her because so many years separated them that my mom, before she left Ireland, had tended to some of her younger siblings, including my Aunt Paula. And so Paula would come to live with us when I was a baby, when I was an infant. And I remember Paula and my sister together sort of looking after me and taking me for walks in the park and the like. And they got along famously. And I got to sort of be connected to the family at home in that way. And ultimately my aunt would return to Dublin and get married there and has a wonderful family of her own who I understand may be tuning in with us. But it really was the nature of things to sort of be open to folks, both from across the world and also just from the States, right? There were all sorts of different people in the States, and we came at things in a way that would judge people by what they were bringing to the party, not by virtue of the zip code they were born into, their religion, their creed, their race. That was not what mattered to us. What mattered to us is what you have to offer. And I think that's a healthy way to look at the world.
But do you recall, Dable, do you recall instances where that kind of norm, you know, in terms of the way your parents carried themselves and how, that's what we learned from what our parents do and the role modeling we see around us. Were there ever instances, or do you remember instances where that openness was kind of called into question in any way around your sensibility of identity or anything like that?
So one thing that is challenging, and I think this probably continues to be the case for parents of biracial or multiracial children, and Miriam, perhaps this is part of your experience, is that because race is such a powerful driver of how we understand the world in the United States, it's almost difficult for people to process that kids that look different than their parent can be kids of that parent, right? And so sometimes I remember as a young person being in stores or walking around with my mom, and sometimes people would treat myself or my brother in a way that was not acceptable, and in a way that didn't understand that we were, you know, that we were standing paces away from our parent. And my mom would respond appropriately and vigorously, right? And so just living in the world where you're a brown person with a fair skinned, you know, jet black hair, light pale blue eyed mom is one difference that sort of separates you by phenotype, even though your genetics are the same. And walking in the world, that was sometimes things that we had to navigate and that I had to see her navigate. But what I recall most is that my mom stood 4'11" and 3/4". It was very important to her that you gave her every fraction of those 3/4 inches. And so she was a diminutive person, a tiny person, but she had the heart of a lion and was unafraid and unabashed. And so, seeing her speak up when she needed to speak up, seeing her navigate and being unafraid to occupy her space, even if her physical space was not great, was something that I learned through observing. And that, you know, I think as a young person, you learn things in different ways. You learn some of the things that your parents do and that you want to emulate. And I dare say, as a parent who was fortunate to see my oldest daughter graduate yesterday, Stella Kathleen, named for my late mom, Kathleen Mary Mortimer, and Sella Kathleen graduated yesterday, but I'm old enough and have been a parent long enough to reflect that there are some things our kids see in us that they want to emulate and capture, and then there's some things that they want to do differently. And I think my mom taught me both lessons over time, as did both my parents.
Actually, that brings us, Debo, to like my next question, kind of in that sense. For both your parents, they're coming from places where race plays a different, or is a different dynamic. Nigeria, presumably, where it's a majority black country, so your father's coming from that predisposition, and your mother, where the non-white population of Ireland is really tiny at the time. Have you any kind of sense of how they navigated like 1950s and 1960s and 1970s America, especially with respect to how the very point you make in that you know, you weren't exactly like your father, you weren't exactly like your mother, you're bits of both of them, which is the unique experience of biracial and multiracial children. I'm just wondering how much you know of how they navigated all of that.
I don't think I know the full set of stories, but I do know that their voices were active ones, and that they were open to understanding the things that mattered to each culture, and that embracing each culture was something that was inherent in who we are. And so there are family photos of me in my mom's arms at UN protests about the Biafran War in Nigeria. And these were pictures that I had seen throughout my life, but I didn't understand until I was a much older person where they were taken or what the significance of that photo was, to see that. And my parents were certainly focused on the civil rights movement and watching as the country was grappling with these issues and thinking about how they affected the world and how they came to be visited upon folks in the United States and in New York City. And I think one way in which it came home is that my mom was very focused on finding the right school for my brother and I, and found a pretty unique school in Manhattan, a place called Manhattan Country School, that was founded to sort of implement King's vision of kids being on the bench together and in the classroom, regardless of where they come from. No racial majority, a sliding scale tuition, an active farm upstate New York. And so you were learning across difference, race, class, and even urban and agrarian life. And my mom was really an advocate. She had only gone to what is the equivalent of the sixth grade, but I said that you can learn some things from what your experiences are and then learn some differences. And she was a vocal advocate that she wanted her kids to be well-educated and go to school and to have different options. So I don't feel like I have full visibility into everything that they confronted, but I have the sense that they were committed to equality and justice and were prepared to speak up when necessary.
And I think just in my limited experience, I think that makes a real difference in terms of the experience of children when they see the parents being very active in that way. So let me then jump then to, how do you end up on Sesame Street?
Yeah, so it's actually a funny story. It was in the early years that I think the show was in its first year or so. It had been an early critical success. The idea for the show, many people have probably heard of it by now, and there've been lots of reflections as the show ages and passes its various anniversaries and birthdays in its own right. And the show was so well received that essentially a cattle call went out. A cattle call is like when they're looking for people to come and audition. I call it audition. It's a little hard to think about how you have kids of 5 years old or 6 years old, what they're really doing to audition. But I have some view of that. And a cattle call went out almost in the way that American Idol would go out and tell people to line up, to sing your hearts out to see if you could be a singer, a contestant on that show. And my mom's friend, one of her good friends, called and said, Kathleen, do you want the boys to be on Sesame Street? And she said, oh, that sounds great. How much does it cost? And she said, no, dummy, they pay you. And so off we went. And I think I went first because my brother was a little bit younger. And I went to audition for the show. And the audition was just, it was a studio. It was a set with the lights and the cameras. And it essentially was a conversation between me and one of the actors. At the time, it was an actor who played David on the show, a fellow whose real name was Northern Calloway. And it was a conversation between David and I, the character David and I, on the set. And as far as I have been able to ascertain, I think what they were looking for was kids who were not distracted or overwhelmed by the artificial context of the bright lights and the camera and all the adults, folks who wouldn't be cowed by it, and perhaps owning to both of my familial traditions, both the Irish and Nigerian side. Talking is something that I have been comfortable doing for a long time. And so I was happily oblivious to what was happening around me. And I was just talking to the person who was talking to me. And so that may have been the thing that aided me in my so-called acting career. And I did the show for almost 9 years because the other birthright and legacy that I have that made me a valuable member of the Sesame Street community. Remember, I told you my mom was 4'11 and 3/4. One consequence of that is that I filmed my last show during my freshman year in high school because I looked like I was about 10 years old. When I made the varsity soccer team in high school, I too was 4'11. There was no uniform that was small enough for me. I had to tape up the sleeves on the uniform so that it would fit me and wouldn't overhang my arms. And so I looked like I was a little kid even when I was a freshman in high school. And on account of that, I got to do the show for many years. And it was interesting, but one of the things that I loved most about it was that the show was international. And so it was shown in Ireland and Nigeria. And my grandparents in both countries got to see my brother and I on Sesame Street. And so there were ways in which being on the show is sort of better in retrospect than it was at the time. I prefer to be out kicking a ball or throwing a baseball than on the set waiting to get called to the set. But one thing that always felt special to me is that the family abroad could see us and could see us on the show. And on one show, I wore a sweater, an Aaron sweater that my grandmother had knit for me and sent to me. And so I was really happy that she got to see me wearing my Irish sweater on Sesame Street.
Well, you know, young people watching this conversation won't appreciate just how significant that is, because in those years, for your grandparents to see you and everything like that, I mean, that would have been such a kind of sensation, right? To physically be able to see you on screen and stuff and see how you were growing and stuff. That's amazing.
Yeah, now we just take the phone out of our pocket or sit in front of our laptop. But certainly in those days, it was very different. You know, people used to write letters and send pictures, and it was very different. The world in some ways, positive and negative, has become a lot smaller. And that's one way in which Sesame Street was able to give a gift that reached beyond the boundaries of the United States.
So, as you mentioned, you do this that for, you know, nine years or so. But when do you decide? Because I want to move into, you know, your decision to go into the law and talk a little bit about the extent to which your identity has informed your decisions in that way. You weren't tempted to go into entertainment or anything?
No, I enjoyed it to some extent, but I was much more interested in sports than I was in acting and television. I did it a little bit here and there, but by my assessment, there were lots of peers that were more gifted in those areas than I was, and it wasn't the thing that got my juices flowing really. So I wanted to take a different tact and a different path. And I guess one way that might have in retrospect been an early leading indicator of how the die was cast for me is that one of the people I got to meet on Sesame Street was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson came, and they would have various famous people, various celebrities come to the show and host the show, as some folks may know. And I happened to be there on a day in the 1970s when Jesse Jackson was there, and he was there, and he sort of charged the kids, the group of kids that were sitting on the steps and around the set of the show, to repeat a poem, a spoken word utterance after him, and it was "I Am Somebody," and that poem, that moment, has been captured in some of the historical records of Sesame Street, and he, you know, he had people repeat after him that in each case that we were saying, "I may be black, I may be white, I may be rich, I may be poor," you know, all of these different things, but "I am somebody." And he kept coming back to that. And I just remember, I didn't really know who Jesse Jackson was as a young boy. I understood that he was somebody who had great presence and bearing, which I found to be interesting. I hadn't been around folks that had that type of gravitas all that often, but in some ways he was able to hold the attention of young people, and his message was that of empowerment and of self-empowerment, right? So it wasn't just that he was a person of consequence, but he was trying to instill in all the kids that they were people of consequence who needed to be regarded and respected. And you know, it's hard to know what formative influences these things have, but I remember looking back on that day and that show and thinking, how funny would it be that Jesse, who was with the late Martin Luther King when he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, would come to Sesame Street all those years later and lead me and a group of others in a poem that somehow has become the arc of the things that I try and fight for every day, so that everybody can realize that they're somebody and they should be regarded and respected.
So tell me about the sequence events, Dabo. Like, when did you know that you wanted to go into, you know, the study of the law as a way to kind of maybe interrogate some of these things that were in your mind, even subconsciously?
Yeah, I think it started fairly early on. I did go to that wonderful school, the Manhattan Country School, and that school has a civil rights curriculum that is part of what they teach, and it also there's various pieces of it that engage with activism and students and young people being able to make a difference in the world. And that was an intentional selection of my parents. And as part of that education, I learned about the civil rights movement. I learned about Thurgood Marshall and some of the leaders of the civil rights movement. And I liked this idea that there was a way to fight to make the world more just, and to see that there were people that were prepared to come forward and to do so, not just for themselves, but for others. And the role that young people played in it was also very compelling to me. And so I think fairly early on, as I've mentioned, I also like to talk to people and to learn from other people and explore and interrogate differences and similarities. I think with every difference, well, you know, the flip side of the difference coin is the similarities point that I've spoken to at various moments. And being open to that and looking for those things, right? Being in conversation so that you can understand what is different and what is the same is an important part of it. And so very early on, I think that I did have the idea that maybe one day I would be a lawyer. And because I was a bit of a chatterbox, my mom used to say that I should become a lawyer because then at some point I would put my mouth to good use. The implicit message there is that as a young person, it probably was engaged in some uses that my mom didn't always value. So she was hopeful that in time it would pay some kind of dividend, and hopefully she was right.
So would you say, I mean, you're first generation American, Dabo, and would you say that not only so that, like, kind of different phenotypes of your parents as one of white European descent and your father is black African descent, and them being immigrants as well, and what, you know, that would have implicitly demonstrated to you in terms of how they were navigating the American experience. So I guess my question is, the type of law that you have ended up practicing and things like that. How significant is your kind of background, your family background, in what you, and maybe tell us a little bit about that kind of sequence of events in terms of your specialization.
I think it is a direct contributor to the path that I've chosen to understand that I was born into a country that, as I said, had laws that forbade the union of people that might care to be together for outrageous reasons that were based in values that had no place and were contrary to human dignity. Just, you know, being born into a country that sort of has those rules and traditions, seeing discrimination and experiencing it up close and then remotely, all of that contributed to the idea. Because I had close knowledge and experience that the things that people fear didn't need to be feared, but could and should be embraced. And so I do think that context, that family origin was part of what motivated me to not want to have people put in boxes for reasons that have no bearing, and to try and be a voice in some way for those folks who might not have the opportunity to carry the fight forward themselves, or framed perhaps more aptly, to be a voice for those people who want to carry the fight forward to make the world more just. And I view the work of civil rights as narrowing the gap between the high constitutional promises that we make here in the United States to treat people with equal protection of the laws and to afford due process to everybody. Those are high promises, but too often the practices are low. And the fight for civil rights, as I regard it, is the constant effort to narrow the gap between our high promises and low practices, and to stay vigilant in that fight, to try and realize the aspiration. And that work is empowering. And I think my family experience of people who came from very, very different traditions and continents to find each other in New York is something that opened me up to being on that path for others, people that are different than me and have entirely different experiences, but recognizing the right that they have to pursue their life, liberty, and happiness.
One of the things that struck me, Dable, I've spent a number of years in New York doing oral histories with people of Irish descent, but I haven't come across very many families like yours, or in fact, like my family in moving forward. Were you aware of, or was that something that, were you conscious of, like, this landscape of, like, Irish organizations and associations and an Irish world in New York? Did your mother in any way engage with that, or was it something that you had any interest in engaging with, or did she feel excluded from? And I ask that in the context of, I made this point to you when we were kind of thinking about some of the questions, 100 years prior, a Black Irish family in New York City in Manhattan wouldn't have been that unusual in the landscape of New Yorkers as they lived in the city. Was that history or absence of the presence in terms of your landscape obvious to you, or did it impede on you or your mother's engagement with her ethnic community in any meaningful way?
It was not very visible to me. I didn't know the history that you shared with me about how common Black and Irish pairings had been throughout history. I hear about an individual case here and there, but I certainly didn't understand it to be commonplace. And as an Irish Nigerian, I sort of thought of the pairing as unique for a long time, until your mind is expanded and we all come to realize that we're not as different as we think we may be. And so I didn't really know about that. And my mom, as I recall it, was not very engaged with societies or external entities. It was more family and friends, and she was deeply engaged with her family and friends. She had two siblings follow her here to the States, and they would settle in New Jersey, and we would spend holidays and have lots of visits with them. And my family would travel from abroad. My paternal grandparents came to visit in New York, and we went to visit my grandparents, both first in Ireland and then in Nigeria. My maternal grandfather came, and so we had deep connections to family and to the traditions, physical and emotional, and by through oral tradition, but not so much to organized parts of the Irish experience in New York or even abroad. That was not as much a focus for my mom as I recall it.
So tell me, Debo, what was it like to visit Ireland for the first time and Nigeria for you? It must have, they must have been great, fascinating experiences.
Truly, truly fascinating. I was very young. I was about five or six years old when I went to Dublin. I remember feeling as if I had been transported in a time capsule. Things that I had heard of but hadn't seen just fascinated me. The idea that there was a milkman that came around on a cart with the glass jars of milk, a horse-drawn carriage. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. I couldn't believe that was really how it happened. We would walk down the corner to the supermarket to get the quart of milk, and seeing that Dublin had sort of this in those days, right, in the early 1970s, still had some of the old world feel. That was interesting. But the other interesting thing was to see the extent to which my family embraced us as the children of the eldest member of my family, and also my dad. And there is a photo that I remember that tickled both my grandfather and my dad to no end, which is both of them had lots of differences in life, but the place that they could meet and join in a single-minded focus is that they both enjoyed a pint of Guinness. And my grandfather took my dad to the Guinness plant in Dublin. And I remember there's a photo of them standing in front of a map that in those days pointed to where there were various Guinness factories around the world. And there was one in Nigeria. And so they were cracking up to see that Guinness of Irish tradition was also in Nigeria. And so the Irish and the Nigerians celebrate and enjoyed that. And so there were different things, seeing all the cousins and getting to meet all of my cousins was extraordinary. And then there was one particularly interesting moment where one day some of my cousins and I were sent to go walk somebody to a bus downtown who was traveling back to their home. And the older cousins were to look after me, and they were teasing me, and they, you know, I was admiring the double decker buses. It's not something I had seen in New York. I thought they were fantastic things as a 5 or 6 year old. And they kept like joking about which bus we were supposed to get on or, you know, planned to get on. And at some point they joked, and I, being 5 years old, stepped onto the bus just before the bus door closed, and off I was, on the bus without my cousins and, taking a big adventure in Dublin, my first trip in a big city by myself. And somehow the bus driver, managed to get me home that evening. But I think I would not have liked to be my cousins when they returned home to explain how they had lost their little cousin on a double decker bus.
Wow. The missing American cousins.
That's it. At least I was easy to pick out.
So that's actually something, Debo. Do you remember being like conscious of the fact that, you know, most of the people you must have seen on that trip were probably phenotypically more like me than you? And then when you went to Nigeria, how was that experience where you were going to presumably a black majority environment?
You know, interestingly, I feel like I remember it more in Nigeria than in Ireland. It was certainly true in both cases. But I think that one of the things that was interesting is that when even on a later trip to Nigeria, my brother and I, being phenotypically different than many of the folks at home in Nigeria, they were sort of interested. Many of the kids around the town and stuff. I would go out to play soccer, which is my favorite thing to do, and it was great to be out there playing. But sometimes as we would drive through one of the towns or villages, there was a Yoruba word for white man. And when folks saw my brother and I didn't understand the word. I didn't know the word. And I heard this word called after my brother and I. And it was very puzzling to me, to be called, that name, because I didn't really regard myself in that way. I wasn't treated that way in the United States. And so to understand how context is everything, and in one place you can appear one way or be viewed another way, and then at another point you can be viewed completely differently. And I would again have that experience after I graduated law school and traveled back to Ireland and spent some time with the aunt who had lived with us. We stayed in her house, and I spent time with my cousins, and my first cousin Connor O'Hearn was for many years the flyweight and the light flyweight national amateur champion boxer in Dublin, and fought in the Dublin Stadium downtown. And Connor was a little boy in those days, and I remember Connor sort of looking at me and trying to figure me out, and it was great. He was so glad to have me there and to figure out his connection to his cousin. And we've remained very close. He now has kids of his own. But it was interesting to see that in Dublin, when my friend and I, who I was traveling with, who was actually Irish American, when we would be asked what we were doing there, we would say we were visiting family, and people always assumed that we were visiting the family of my Irish American friend, even though we were visiting and staying with my family. Rich Carter is my friend's name. And that was his first trip abroad and to Ireland. I had gone to an earlier trip in Rio that summer. And when I was in Rio, people would speak to me in Portuguese all the time and expect me to respond because they thought I was Brazilian, but I couldn't respond because I didn't speak Portuguese. And so that, you know, at various times you come to understand that context and the assumptions people make, are very often about race. But they don't always tell the whole story.
Well, that brings me to my next question, Dable. Do you have examples in your life experiences of how your connection to being Irish and self-identifying as being Irish in any way has come into conflict with you, you being perceived as a black man or a brown man in the United States? Did you ever feel a tension in that?
So one interesting thing that I've studied and thought about and worked in the space a little bit is sort of the history of law enforcement in the United States and police departments. And, years ago, folks used to call the wagon that police used to round up to gather folks that were arrested and presumably going to be charged with some crime or other. They called it the paddy wagon. And it was named for Irish. It was named for Irish Americans because they were frequently rounded up by the police department, and they would grab a bunch of Irishmen who were up to whatever they were up to, and found them in some connection with law enforcement having criminal contact. And so I thought about the extent to which the paddy wagon, named for Irish folks as people that were in custody in law enforcement, and then the extent to which Irish Americans came to be such a big presence in law enforcement in the United States. And I have worked on behalf of the accused in many contexts, on behalf of people that have been accused of serious crimes, sometimes capital murder, and committing heinous crimes, and having either committed such crime or been accused of committing such crime. And so I've had a lot of opportunity to be engaged in structural understanding of law enforcement and ethnicity and race and how these things interact. And there have been, certainly there have been, points of friction in which, I have been portrayed as some person that is out of the mainstream or you know, acquitting myself in some way in connection with the representation of my clients that somehow was appropriate to single out for condemnation when I've been engaged, only in vindicating the rights under our system of the accused. And in talking to folks and engaging with law enforcement and in talking about my cases and things, it's interesting to see how sometimes in society there are those who are focused on improving things and having structural reform and making things more fair, which many people are engaged in. And then there is also a phenomenon in which sometimes groups, and this has happened with various immigrant groups over time, have been focused on changing their position in the pyramid rather than leveling off the pyramid and making it more egalitarian. And I think both strains run through the Irish American story. There are people that have been very active and on the front lines of the equality movement and of fighting for equality. Folks that have been deeply engaged in all sorts of fights for civil rights, and also even in the area of criminal justice reform and law enforcement reform. And then there are some other folks that are most concerned about, you know, not being at the bottom of the pyramid and having their social status change in the pyramid so that they're not the caboose, as it were. And it's interesting to sort of understand the way in which both strands exist in the Irish American community, and both strands, you know, exist for in many communities. But I've seen that up close and personal, and it has been interesting to engage on those issues and to sort of come to understand it in some ways, even if at points it can be in sharp relief and very it can become very heated in the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Debo, I'm conscious of time, and I know for some people who are coming up on the hour, we will segue to some questions there. But just one that I, because we did mention this, you did mention it in passing when we spoke before, Debo, that you have this similar lineage to the first black president of the United States, Barack Obama. Were you ever in a position to talk to him about your common ancestral heritage at all?
We didn't ever get to engage on that topic. Interestingly enough, the first time I met President Obama was the day after I had been voted down by the United States Senate to serve as the chief civil rights law enforcement officer for the United States. My wife and I went to a ceremony at the White House. It was the Women of Soul concert, and we were there with Michelle and Barack as their guests after the Senate had filibustered, stopped. They hadn't allowed my confirmation to go through because I had represented a prisoner successfully under sentence of death and was able, with a team of able colleagues who did the real work to get that death sentence commuted under our laws and adjudicated by a federal court. And so that was the occasion at which I was at the White House and with the president and Michelle Obama. We didn't get to engage on this topic, though I do remember when Obama traveled to Ireland in his presidency, and there was that song that somebody had, "There's nobody more Irish than Barack Obama." And had I had the opportunity to speak to him, I would have informed him that actually I am more Irish than Barack Obama.
Yeah, truly. Next time, Debo.
I'll save that one.
Yeah. Debo, you know, before I share you, and this has been a wonderful conversation, and I hope that we get up an opportunity to engage further with you and your story and do more justice to the story than we can do in 75 minutes. But it's wonderful to share this publicly with our the people joining us from all over today, from the UK, from Ireland, from the United States, the tri-state area and beyond. Like, why, Debo, you've been generous in terms of your time and interest in this project and what we're doing with this series. Why did you want to participate in what we're doing in this vein?
So I am a big believer, for many of the reasons that I've described, that knowing the place from which you've come, knowing your family story and the family traditions, understanding that lineage helps provide some roots for you to decide what your own path is going to be, but to put your own mark on it, but to put that mark in the world in a way that takes account of from whence you came and those who went before you. And to look back, to look forward is a very important aspect, I think, of human understanding, of identity, of engagement, and of understanding a bit across differences. And as I said, with every difference, there are similarities that are important. So to know that you are digging into this category of folks who, as I have confessed, I thought was relatively unique and extraordinary, but I now come to understand that it's much more common than I would have imagined, to know that you're speaking to a cohort of folks that have these different experiences, but in some ways common lineages, is a treasure trove of human experience that I think should be explored and that we can learn from. So when I heard about it, I definitely wanted to be a part of it, and I'm grateful that it exists, and I think it adds something to NYU, and it adds something more broadly to those of us of Irish and African, various African lineages. It's an important area, and I feel grateful to be a part of it.
Well, what's wonderful, Dabo, is your story adds another, you know, vein, or, you know, there's some wonderful analogies about quilts and stuff like that, another layer to the ways in which people come to identify. And Rosemary Adesser has done such wonderful work in the field of mixed race Irish. And I absolutely concur. And the language and how, you know, how people self-identify as being Black and Irish, or of African descent and Irish and things like that, it's a lot of the time very inadequate and very personal in terms of the individual, right? And I totally take the point. And to Dabo's earlier point in terms of the context in different places, you know, and even, you know, the term Black Irish can mean so much in different ways. So I absolutely take any critique, or, you know, totally take on board kind of the questions of the language that we use, and in particular, how people prefer to self-identify.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life, and thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.